Hello, and welcome to the Legendarium Green Team. I'm Jingles90, and with me today are Cheskier, Little Red Book,
hello,
and Texas Blade.
Hey.
Today we are discussing Book 1 of the Alex Viris series, Fated, by Benedict Jacka. Since this is the beginning of a new series for the Green Team, we'll start off with some overall non-spoiler impressions of the series from those who have read it before. And then we'll get into spoilers for this book further into the discussion. So, thoughts on the series overall? Texas, why don't you start us off?
Alrighty. This is at least the fourth time I think I've been through it. I have the bad habit of re-listening to favorite book series, and also I started it when it was coming out. So I guess it's been through, I don't know. I think at least four times, but I think I've only done like the last books once when they came out. But I enjoy it. Particularly, you know, Dresden Files is one of my favorites. I think everyone who is around knows that. So, and this is it's got a nice similar but different take that I really like. And I almost wish we had some British people to weigh in on that aspect of it, too, because that would be interesting.
That's actually something I've noticed on the Discord. We have like a odd blank space for the Brits, or at least they don't seem to be as vocal as everyone else is.
Either they're not as vocal or it's all when we're offline.
Yep, exactly.
I was just going to say Jack's a Brit.
Yeah, he is. He is British.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, is he? Okay.
As you may have noticed when reading it, he sometimes gets very descriptive about, like, I took the L train to get to this spot, and it's, sometimes that it's good, and sometimes I'm like, just tell me you took the train to get there. I don't need the 17 steps you took to the left and then a jig to the right, but I really like it. This will be my second time through the whole thing. I've read the first four or five. I think three or four times, just, you read it, you catch up, you wait a year or two, then you read it again and catch up to where it is next. I think the book goes really well. I think that it's a really good urban fantasy series. It really plays to that strong where it is an urban setting, an urban fantasy setting. Some impressions from the series, like, this is not a series... I don't want to spoil anything. I can't say that. I have lots of good thoughts. It's a fun series. I think it delves into a couple topics really well, and we'll kind of figure those out as we go along. But I don't think... I would say it never gets as expansive as, like, the Dresden series. So if you're used to the Dresden series, like, you're going to see a couple similarities in certain things. But it never goes that expansive where he's... taking on all sorts of new things. It stays a little bit more local to home. But I think the story is really good and
indeed,
and really asks some hard questions that makes you answer them to yourself.
Mm. Cool. Yeah, I've kind of gathered, at least from this book, it's hard to always say with the first book because they usually start smaller to begin with, but I kind of find that right now I'm appreciating the kind of smaller scale. It feels more like a one-off instead of the beginning of a series.
So this is my second time through the series. I am very glad to say that the first time I read it, I did not have to take notes or think about it because I was just reading it for fun. I enjoy this immensely. And as far as comparison to Dresden, I feel like the quality of the books are much more consistent. So Dresden has some great books, and then it has some really not so great books that were, I wouldn't say bad, just they were okay. So I really appreciate that about this series. And I also like how there's a little, the opening is fabulous for this book. I laughed so hard because he's talking about how he sees he's a psychic, basically. But it does have this really funny little shout out to, I even heard that there was a wizard advertising in the Yellow Book in Chicago, but I'm sure that's just an urban rumor. It's like one of the, it was like in the first three paragraphs of the opening. And I just found that very cute and cheeky of him to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with a lot of what you said.
I also want to say that I am going to try to react to this book as if I have not read the entire series, only because I have major changes in my feelings about characters from the first book to the last book.
Well, that's, okay. I mean, realistic. There's a lot of characters to develop here. Well, I mean, not a lot, but there's a lot of development of characters that goes on, so...
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying that because I want everyone to understand that I'm going to say things about characters in this book that when we do the last book, I'm going to say very different things about.
Oh, I feel the same. Yeah.
And Chesky knows who those characters are.
Fair enough. Yeah, so this is my first read through of this entire series, so I'm going in completely blind. So yeah, I will try not to read too much into anything you say that might break back. I did really enjoy this book. It is a very fast read. I started reading it a couple weeks ago thinking I needed to give myself some time to prepare for this. And then I got through it in like 2 days. Oh, that's it. All right. Cool.
That's right.
So, and it does kind of end suddenly too. Not in any of the main events, but the wrap up is, you know, I think all of 3 pages, which is kind of hilarious. But yeah, I think the Dresden stuff is readily apparent. I mean, there's plenty of similarities to them that I think probably could equate to their... be equated to any sort of urban fantasy. Name a magician or an angel who don't have some sort of shop that they have as a front. I really enjoyed it, and the comparisons are pretty clear and pretty evident for me at this point for the two.
So is this your, I guess this wouldn't be your first urban fantasy then, right?
No, this is, I'm well into the urban fantasy.
Perfect.
Reading.
I was going to ask you, as a first timer, did you have a lot of, what were your expectations coming into Alex Varus? You know, hearing, you know, as you might have heard that like it is urban fantasy, it's kind of similar to Dresden. Like, what were you expecting and what did you get when you finished?
Okay. I pretty much was just expecting another Dresden, if I'm being totally honest, because that's the strongest comparison that you get. So, you know, was expecting first person, was kind of expecting kind of a noir type feel, was expecting, you know, some sort of deeper mythology that wasn't going to be fully explored up front, probably was going to be a very specific case that was going to happen and play through. And to some extent, I got all of that. what was actually kind of lacking from Alex, which I enjoyed, compared to Dresden, is just the lack of misogyny, honestly.
Like, I knew you were gonna say that. Like
it was just like, oh, this is refreshing. Like, he's not a total yeah, exactly. I was like, oh, he is going to, you know, one of Dresden's huge things is he'll never hit a woman or whatever. This guy has no qualms with fighting people who are fighting him, which I appreciate. And then, you know, I didn't expect the whole kind of changeover from being an urban fantasy, but also kind of becoming more of like a Indiana Jones Tomb Raider style artifact quest instead of detective, which was really fun. I enjoyed all the traps and things. So
good.
So yeah. Should we give a spoiler warning now?
Well, we were just talking about expectations.
Yeah.
I don't think that's
okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
We can get into the spoilers of the series now. Whoever wants to give that one.
Yeah. Yeah, so let's do that, and then I'll just give a brief summary of the book. So in a world where there's legend of a wizard solving crimes in Chicago, there is a diviner in London making every effort to stay out of the battles of light and dark. Unfortunately, Alex Viris can't stay out of all of their business. Members from both factions are hunting Alex down, desperately looking to balance their odds of success in one very important mission. The mission? To retrieve an ancient staff called the Fate Weaver from the tomb of Mage Abithriax. Viris will pull his best Bond and Laura Croft impressions to get the staff before anyone else.
Well done.
Thank you. So, yeah, so that's where we are. Yeah, I guess let's just get into your general thoughts about this book specifically, and we can talk spoilers. So, Red, you want to start us off there?
This book contains one of my very favorite scenes in this whole series, which is when Alex and Luna go to the dance, and she gets to touch somebody, because she can't touch somebody, because she has this curse that when she gets close to people, it basically kills them. And I just thought, in the midst of all the craziness that's going around in this whole nonsense with the blackmail and the this and the that and the machinations of the different mages, you have this quiet moment where she gets to dance with somebody for the first time in her life. And I love that scene so much. It has a lot of other great scenes. And I mean, we have Arachne. Like the Arachne, but she's a giant spider who makes clothes for people.
Which I love that we have a good spider, because spiders almost always, you know, the dark evil, which it makes sense because of where they often live, but it's cool to have a good one. I kind of like spiders.
Anti-Shelob is what she is.
Yeah.
I don't mind spiders as long as they're not in my shower or in my bedroom. Those are the only places I don't really like spiders.
Fair enough.
But they're guarding you there from all the nasty bugs.
I know, but not when they're in your shower.
I have a ban on all bugs everywhere in my house, so you know, I don't need a guardian in the shower. There's already no bugs there.
So this Jesus. Isn't like such a tangent. One time, a spider fell off the ceiling onto me as I was trying to go to sleep, and I could not find it, and I had like horrible nightmares the whole night.
That is nightmare fuel. Absolutely.
But overall, I think it's a really fun introduction to this world. It doesn't overwhelm you with info dumps, really. You get to see.
There's a lot that could be explained.
Yeah, there's. You know.
That yes, is not.
Exactly. It doesn't have info dumps. It just feels very natural. You step into this guy's head, and it's not first person, but it's his perspective. And he's just like, dude, I just want to be left alone from you people. Like, I just leave me alone. And he keeps getting sucked into the situation. So anyway, I'm done. I've talked a lot, so.
I think he does a lot of, like, his exposition, at least about his magic system, just in the way of showing much more than telling, where he's like, he's in a fight, and he's like, okay, I'm going to maneuver this, I'm going to see this, I can tell that he's going to do this, and then he reacts appropriately, you know, both explaining his magic and the other person's magic, but not being too over the top and being like, let me lay out the 16 rules of magic that I've, you know, compiled that everybody should know. Now, he does that on his website, so if you want more, you're more than welcome to read it on the website.
I need to go.
Yeah, he has like a whole encyclopedia arcana where he goes into like deep dives of like the magic and stuff, but it's all on his website, on his blog, and so it's there if you want it, but you don't have to like read it to get the story. You get enough from the books to understand everything that happens.
Okay. Yeah, I think I would only push back a little bit on the exposition, just because when I was starting to get into the first chapter or so of the book, kind of catching on to what Jacka's prose kind of was, it flowed very easily, and it felt very much like a, you know, kind of more of a bestseller thriller style. And every once in a while, I'd catch myself that I had gone on autopilot because it was moving so smoothly that I was like halfway through a description of what the difference between light and dark mages was before I even realized that I had just like missed a total exposition piece, you know, just giving a thorough explanation of a thing. So, and I did that a couple times. I don't think that's any fault of Jacka's, and it definitely suited the point at which he was choosing to explain it. I just found it interesting that, you know, I was getting such a deep lore piece right away, which it was also the introduction of those two factions, so not too surprising it was happening.
Yeah, so what is the difference there between a light mage and a dark mage?
Yes.
Why
yes,
don't you enlighten us all?
Well, I think it seems at this point a little bit more in line with maybe order and chaos than actual, like, light and dark. Maybe they're, because I gotta be honest, I don't see much difference from their bureaucrats.
I
have nothing to say.
I'm
not
spoiling
gonna say
anything. I'm just gonna say anything. I'm just gonna stay quiet and say,
but you know, bureaucrats are, you know, they're kind of evil. That's what I will say to that.
Sure.
Yeah, he's definitely going with the either power corrupts or power allows corruption to show, kind of. I don't know if anyone else has said it, but I kind of feel it's not that power corrupts, but power allows corruption. It gives you gives someone the feeling they don't need to hide their corruption. Mm-hmm. Let's say, as opposed to it actually being the corrupting influence.
Right.
They have lots of power.
So one of the things that I like about how they show the difference at the beginning is that the Light Council, even though they have internal factions within it, they are working within the rules mostly. Whereas
they work within the rules completely, Red. What are you talking about? They're rule followers. No, just you didn't expect that.
Do the letter.
Or you didn't read the rules carefully. Does not excuse you from not following those rules exactly.
Oh my god. I'm having flashbacks from anyway. So where the dark mages, they're all kind of on their own. And it's much more like overtly, like, what's his face? Co-ops Onyx. Mm-hmm. He's just like, because I'm more powerful than you, you have to do what I say.
Would any of you guys disagree with equating it almost to like the Jedi and the Sith? The Jedi have
soul. That seems to be the closest analog to me.
And
yeah,
the Sith are power rules. Whoever's the strongest is the one in charge in any group, kind of a thing.
I kind of feel like it's if the Jedi were less, I feel like the Jedi care more about living up to what they're saying than the Light Council. Light Council seems kind of, the only difference is that they pay lip service to laws and stuff like that. But I don't know. There's not a whole lot of difference.
I'm going to disagree a little bit. Definitely in the upper echelons, but Saunders really does believe.
Yeah.
Like, okay. The top dogs don't really care. Don't. But the lesser people, which makes sense. They have less power, therefore they have less they have less freedom to.
Well, and Saunders is also just what they want. So like he's just naive.
Yeah, he's pretty young in this one.
Well, I'm also trying to remember, like, who's the, what's the other guy's name that asked for their help? I think it starts with a T, but I'm totally drawing a blank right now.
Yeah, no, I know who you're talking about. He's the guy.
But, yeah.
You know, I think he still qualifies as a light mage, right? It's just.
Yes.
He's actually a light mage trying to enforce Elson, the ideals.
Right?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course. Because he is trying to actually enforce what light mages can do, he also sometimes proves to be a little incompetent. You know, like because he actually isn't willing to do some more backhanded things, and he's also just not prepared.
Yeah, well, he's not a top tier.
Yeah,
he's not.
All right,
he's on the council, middle, isn't he?
I think.
No,
I'm pretty sure he's a middle guy.
I think this is a better discussion once we see a little bit more than just this first book, because we don't really deal a whole lot with the council.
Yeah, he's just a little bit here and there.
Jingles, you're running the show here. Is there a favorite scene? Yeah, you're in charge. Really good scene you wanted to talk about, force us to talk about?
I don't know. I want to go back to Arachne a little bit, just because I did love her entire involvement in this story. And going back to Red's the mission to go to the party or whatever, actually giving Luna that opportunity to be a person for a day was wonderful. I thought that was great. Well, incredibly well done.
That was a really good touching scene there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you, I guess we can talk a little bit about the end of the book. How do you all feel about the use of like traps and dungeon crawling at the end of this story?
Like when they're in the portal section?
Like when they're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it was great. And it makes sense when you look at it from the context of not, this is some guy's tomb that we're, you know, taking this artifact from, but more like, this is a spot where we're locking this dangerous artifact away forever. We don't want anybody to get to it. And so of course they're going to put traps, and of course they're going to, you know, lock it up. And like,
I think they put the traps so just in case they decide they really, really need it, they can get back in. If you want to lock that something up forever, you toss it, you know, in that void, and then you just destroy the gate. They still want to, they're powerful. They still want the option of grabbing that if they figure out how to use it safely.
I agree with that, except for the fact that everybody basically forgot about what was in there because they did not keep their records well. backup.
I mean, yeah. That they didn't want anyone to be able to use it. Whoever knew the data, you know, someone probably squirreled away that data and destroyed all the duplicates so that only I can get it if I want to.
Well, Abernathix even says that there's been multiple attempts to wield the wand, and that he has been, basically what he does is he takes over people's minds and then he gets forgotten about somehow. And he's like, I've been alone for so long, which is so sad for you. I'm sorry.
Well, that was before he was locked away. Body hop, basically, and then they locked him away finally.
Okay. Well, I guess I missed
that. Right.
Yeah.
Because he never got out of that once he was put in.
Yeah. I think even at one point, Virus says the staff has been undisturbed for 2,000 years. I had no problem leaving it there for another 2,000. Yeah.
Now, while we're talking about this, like, how cool was it, though, to see Alex wielding the Fate Weaver? Wasn't that just most baller?
That was amazing.
Couple scenes you've ever seen. I mean, I don't want to. I'm going to talk about it a little bit because it's just so amazing. Where he's like, "Oh, I saw the discs of force coming at me, and then they weren't." You know, I looked in the future. I saw where they wouldn't be, where it wouldn't hit me, and then they were going that way instead of, you know, the right way. And he's just like, "It was just. It's an epic, you know, ending fight right there." I mean, opinions, please confer with me.
Well. I totally agree. I also love the fact that this is like they chose Jaka chose to show how overpowered Virus can be with the right tools right away.
Yeah.
Because now we know exactly what he's capable of at any given moment. Whereas, you know, I think like comparing it to other stuff, usually you have that build up until you get to that point. It was really cool. I just love the, you know, since I'm a diviner holding a wand that allows me to choose fates, I can actually see all of them and then just choose one instead of working my way through all of the possibilities.
Which he does.
Having to find the chain of causality, I guess, or something like that. I think that's
changes the chain.
Yeah, he just sees the future he wants and picks that and pulls that one out straight with the wand. Yeah, it was...
It's like using a cutter.
Although I gotta say, I do love the scenes where he's like, I spent an hour like walking through all these different things to solve the puzzles or whatever. That was really fun to watch. And I, as far as dungeon crawling, that was pretty cool. He's like, okay, so Sonder, go over there. Wait, Okay, say this word. No, say this word. Don't touch the thing yet. Just say the words. And he keeps it's like,
yeah, I mean, that's kind of getting into one of Kipton's questions about why is divination magic overpowered. I don't think it really is, because there's not always going to be the scenarios where, you know, Alex is going to be the person who's going to get to be able to do the things. He can see the outcomes, but yeah, he's going to have to communicate out to someone else and hope that they follow through correctly.
Yeah. I would say that divination magic could very easily be overpowered. Very easily,
yeah.
You know, be too much. But Benedict Jackson,
it has the blanking on the word, but he can't see past a decision that hasn't been made.
Right.
So there are big limitations to that.
And I think, I think Benedict Jack does it really well, where he says, I'm going to give this guy an overpowered magic. I'm not going to make it overpowered, you know, except for that one scene where we see how powerful it can be. But it's really limited by like, okay, I can see this future, but that doesn't mean I can suddenly turn this person. I'll know the exact right thing to say to this person to turn them on my side. No, that person will never be on your side. So the best you can do is hope to get away scot-free, you know, without getting hurt. Or things like that. So
he also has to be paying attention to the future, because we see that when he gets captured in the car, is he's looking at one particular future and is not looking for dangers to himself.
But it does allow him to see 13. So 13, we haven't talked about yet. She's an elemental spirit that's been zombified, is the best way to describe it.
By Levistus, who we also haven't talked about, yeah. I believe.
And
The White Council, the good guy. The good guy.
Red,
leader.
Red, I see your hands. Put them down. No scare quotes here. We are not pinching or indicating anything.
I guess the Light Council guy, we can call him. That's accurate.
But you know, he's obviously not a good guy, because he's zombified an air elemental.
Maybe that air elemental was a really, really mean air elemental, and he needed to be zombified.
I mean,
I don't know. We have a sample of two, and half of them are really nice. So, maybe a little bit lackadaisical and not always paying attention.
I'm going to voice my inner Kipton here and say you need a larger sample size.
Yeah, that's fair.
Well, I think the Starbreeze, which is the other elemental we get, she is a wild one. So I think it's safe to say she's probably a good example of normal elementals, wind elementals, that is, because I think they describe her as, you know, she's an airhead. Go figure.
She's very flighty. And I think that Alex's reaction to 13 pretty much shows that this is not okay.
Okay. I'm just trying to play the advocate here a little bit, so we're not
advocate for
trying to spoil anything. I mean, I'm pretty sure everybody got bad feels from Levistus the first time you see him, but let's divorce that future knowledge from us right now.
Jacka is not hiding the ball with this guy. He's not. He's a bad dude. Well, what do you think he's a good guy, Jingles?
No, not at all. No doubt in my mind that he's not. So if y'all are playing me right now,
well, we'll find out in just a couple books. Don't you worry.
I think we already found out, Chesky. I don't think
I know.
Little devil's advocate there. I don't. Yeah, doesn't cut it.
Jumping a little bit backwards, backwards in many ways, but we talk about the solving puzzles and stuff. Does anyone else feel like the puzzle of the key was a bit obvious? I mean, it's the first book, so I kind of expect things like that, but
which part of it?
I feel like he should have figured that out. That red cube was what they needed to open the thing. I feel like there was lots of obvious breadcrumbs that Virus should have been able to. I mean, I guess we're not, we as the reader are not fearing for our life, so maybe that. But I feel like he should have figured it out pretty easily.
Maybe
I think this is kind of a weird issue of meta narrative and how it kind of interacts with the reader versus what
maybe
the world is introduced.
Yeah.
Because I think Alex has a lot more options and knowledge than we do. And we only have a set presentation of things. So when, you know, in the first book that I'm reading of, from a person where they introduce an artifact and a statue that needs an artifact to open, and those are the only things I've got to work with, I'm going to put them together.
Well, you don't, though, because you have the artifact when they first find it, and you know Cinder, or I guess our first bad guy, really, that we see, we know he's going to attack Virus if he sees that thing. Right. And then by at the first quarter-ish time, when they actually invade for the first time, when Virus is scoping things out on his own, they put a cube in that hand, and he knows who it is, and he knows what they want. I feel like right there he should have figured out why the cube would have caused them to attack and everything like that. And it's not...
But he doesn't know why they want to put the cube in the hand of the statue in the first place. He knows that it
may be that since I've gone through it a few times, which is why I'm asking, how obvious it was for y'all. Do you remember when you figured it out?
I think the first time I read it, it was kind of obvious, but I think for a first book, you know, because this was basically his debut, right? Or it was his debut. I don't think it's bad for it to be so obvious, because he's trying to just get people hooked on, you know, get connected to Alex and get connected to this. And so to have a mystery that the reader can solve first makes the readers feel good about it. And then watching him finish it, you know, makes it you know, more sympathetic or more realistic or related to. So
the only thing that I don't, I kind of. But I'm somebody who doesn't try and figure things out. I just let the narrative unfold before me. I would say the part where it had to be Luna was not obvious from the beginning.
That I can see.
No, that was...
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you could disagree with me. Like I said, I read a lot of mysteries and I don't solve them. I don't try to. I just let the story happen.
Luna's, I can't remember from the book now at this point, but Luna's role on why she has the cube and why, or has, it's a sphere?
It's a cube.
Yeah. Why she has the cube and why she needs to be the one to open the cube, I don't recall getting much explanation for that.
I think because it practically chose her, right? Because she's searching for her stick is she goes looking for items for Alex, and then this one just happened to appear for her in a place that wasn't expected. And then as soon as she picked it up, it kind of bound to her.
Yeah,
right. Okay.
Yeah, because they have this whole thing with imbued items have personalities, like Alex's cloak that he wears, his mm-hmm. miscloak, is it called?
Which I think we go into more in other books, but he mentions it.
And the wand is the same thing. It's an imbued item, so it has a personality, and you have like he explains like you have items that are just like one use items that are can store things, and then items that are imbued. And so there was a little bit of an information dump about that.
Yeah,
so.
I recall that.
I don't think there was anything. I think it's super easy to miss, though, just that, like, you know, she chose it, she activated it, kind of, and then, like, you know, it wouldn't work for anybody else.
Yeah, that was a relatively subtle thing that it bound to her, I think.
Guys, this is Hiran Fan's silly question. Oh, no. Is this a Portal fantasy book?
Yes, it is.
They do make Portal fantasy. Yes, they do.
No uncertain terms that this is not a Portal fantasy book.
No, the statue is a portal because it.
Well, they use their gate. It's a gate, actually.
Reality off.
Does the majority of the book happen in the portal?
The whole last end of the book.
That's like an hour of his time out of like a week or 2 weeks of the book. Actually, like,
I'm just saying, there's a portal, but, and that it's separated from reality, The statue is the way into that new reality.
I can't even get into this with you, Brett. Too many arguments about things like this. Having one thing in a book does not make that genre. That'd be like if a gun appeared, it's a gun book. This is definitely not a gun book, right?
Well, he does carry a gun.
There are guns.
Doesn't make it a gun book. Let me just clarify here again. So I'll back off on it now. You guys are good.
Chesky's just like, I'm getting this out of the way now.
Man alive.
I'm not doing this. I'm getting it done.
All right. There's other portals too, though.
I will take my stand and I will die on this hill.
Yeah, it's
and
definitely
you cannot
not.
Stop me.
Look, where is Richard? Where is Richard?
Okay, again, Richard's not the main character of the book.
And we don't even know anything about where he is in this book.
Yeah, don't say anything about that, Red. You're spoiling it for poor Jingles here.
I'm not.
He's going to be so shocked when he reads and finds a Richard in the book now.
No!
Ruin everything for him.
We talk about Richard.
Yeah, but nothing about him in portals.
No.
I'm just teasing, Red. Just teasing. It's all good.
I know. And my gratitude list was happy portal fantasy gratitude list.
And I disagreed with it significantly, but that's neither here nor there. Jingles, take control of this podcast before we go.
Hey, you're the one who went rogue. I don't know.
Tell Red to shut up. That's okay. It's fine.
let's talk a little bit. How do you all feel about Rachel, Cinder, and Khazad as side villains? Because I enjoyed them. Cinder and Khazad was a pretty one note, but Cinder, that being said, I enjoyed everything that played out the way it did with him. Cinder and Rachel, I'm looking forward to a lot more, especially since Alex and Rachel have that history. So, and that was one of the things I did like about the ending of this book, is how many people just kind of disappear.
Yeah, you'll never see him again. What are you talking about? You'll never see him again.
Go do their own things.
No.
Yeah, I was like, they're never going to see him again. I know, I think there's one line where Lavistus and Melnibone, aren't those their names? Yeah. Alex just kind of waves them off as being like, oh yeah, there's never going to be any problems with them again. Now that I don't have their thing, I'm not important. I was like, yeah, nonsense. That's BS.
That's not how you run a 13 book series off of unimportantness and boringness. Like,
well, I was also, I'm sorry, but two high ranking, like, dangerous people.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that Cinder, very definitely in this book, plays the role of a stereotypical dark mage, right? I have power, you don't have power, you listen to me, right? I have power, oh, you have power, okay, I'll listen to you, but we'll negotiate, right? He's able to portray that really well.
So I like them as a trio, and I think it's fair to say that what's his face that was not Cinder or Rachel is one, because whatever. I don't say names, guys.
If you listen to this podcast,
you know I don't say names. So I think it was more that he was just really ticked off that Alex kept one-upping him. Like, he throws him off the roof and into a garbage can, like, at their very first meeting. So, whatever. It was fun. It was fun to have them as kind of like the side quest, I guess, or a side quest.
Yeah.
And I feel like even as they're not like major villains, they're, at least not in this one, they're not a major villain, right? But they're still impactful enough to really derail Alex. You know, they're not like, oh, it's Team Rocket. They just, you know, they see you later. You didn't do anything to this. You just took up some time, right? They actually have an impact in the story.
Right. Yeah, I think they're one of those special cases where the thugs have much more to say and do than the actual villain. If that's what we want to see Morden as.
I just thought of another portal.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, Red.
There's portals everywhere.
The dream. The dream world.
Make it portal fantasy.
Okay, anyway.
I did have a note of what to ask what you all thought about the dream world.
Spinning, trying to, you know, cut off all that future knowledge I have. It's interesting. And it's creepy. Yeah, powerful, but very dangerous. Very high risk, sometimes high reward.
It feels kind of Lovecraftian to me in that way, where it's very much like just because you have access to this place and because you have some control over it does not mean you should trust what it is doing at any given time, because you can never be totally sure what's happening. So I did like that aspect of it. And I think there's interesting things coming into play here. There's like prophecy, which I don't know how that plays with a diviner, if that's like where those intersect, if that's part of just what I should expect from his power set or what.
Are you talking about the part where the dragon gives a prophecy?
Yeah.
I think I enjoyed it. I did not find it creepy or scary in this book. It was kind of cool. Him having to walk, well, first him meeting his old fellow apprentice, and there's actually a kind of funny moment where he's like, oh, is it really you? And she's like, no, it's just a shadow of me. It's like, oh, I wasn't sure if you were dead or alive. And she says something like, what, me not calling you for the last 10 years wasn't a clue. And she gives him the prophecy, and then she has him walk through Richard's mansion, and he has to walk past all these different scenes from his apprenticeship, including the one where he kills one of his fellow apprentices, and for killing Chandra, I believe her name is, because you keep getting hints of all these things in the past from his apprenticeship with Richard, including like he wakes up in a sweat several different times from a dream where he's screaming. And so I enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good way to let us know why Alex is the way he is. So I liked the world. I didn't find it horrifying, except in the sense that you have to see what Alex went through.
I guess that brings up a good point about like the delineation of dark and light mages. Like, we know the dark ones do some really, really evil stuff. And it's made Alex kind of ruthless in a way, because that's his only survival mechanism. So a lot of depth for his character there.
On the one hand, the dark mages, they don't pretend. They just do what they want, and there's no pretense. Whereas the light, apparently, these are all bad, but they seem to be just as cutthroat. They just hide it and stuff. So, which is worse?
Yeah.
Trying to suppress my future knowledge. Suppress it.
I think that actually gets us to our last question from listeners from Saladan. Oh, it's a bit of a darker question, and he spoiler tagged it for context. But have you ever read a torture scene in a fantasy or sci-fi book that was done well in the aspects of drama to the story? Or are they close to a cheap tactic to overwhelm the reader and force a specific tone or
feeling? So I just want to say, in context to this, this particular listener bounced off the series because of the torture scene in the middle of this book. And maybe this says something about me. I was like, torture scene?
I did the same thing.
I reread the middle of the book, and I was like, oh, they're talking about when Mordant tortures the girl for not getting Alex to come with her. I was like, and to me, that was a really, like, it's mostly off screen. Like, you know she's being tortured, but you don't know anything. And then there's hints that Alex was tortured. But if this listener feels this way about this book, they should not read further in the series.
Yeah. I don't want to spoil anything, but let's just say in a little bit in the future, there's
there's more torture.
There's a chapter, there's a couple scenes where it gets really, well, there's more than just a little bit, but yeah, it's a couple that are really intense that make you be like, wow.
It's almost like it's a favorite tool of dark mages, and those are a key player in these books.
So how I would answer this is that the most useful and necessary use of torture that I felt was justified is in Traitor's Blade.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
But I go read Traitor's Blade and then listen to us talk about that.
Yeah.
Which book series is
it? Great Coats.
Yeah.
By Sebastian de Castell.
And also has one of the most gratuitous and unnecessary scenes of torture in the second book, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Sounds like it can go on the maybe one day list.
It makes me cry. But that's not there.
It makes Chesky cry. Okay, guys.
But that's not hard. Lots of things to make Chesky cry. You know, the Lion King's playing in the background. Chesky will start crying. Don't worry about it. No, so I would say that torture scenes are very easy to fall into trying to force the reader to feel either empathy for somebody to see what they're going through or disgust at what the other person is doing. I don't think that Jacka is playing it just to try and make you feel sympathy for Alex, because at this point we already know Alex. We already like Alex. You know, we're in his head. We're with him. And I don't feel like he's trying to force. I think he's more just reinforcing, like, this is how dark mages do stuff. He gave her a task. She failed. She's going to get punished. I'm not going to back down from my word because that's what I said. And if I back down, I lose credibility and I lose power. And if I lose power, then somebody else can come over to me and do the same to me. And I don't want, you know, I think it explains a little bit. It intimates a little more than just dark mages bad. It gives a little bit more of that understanding of why they're doing things. Like I said, though, have you ever read a torture scene that was done well? Yes. Traitor's Blade. I don't think it was bad in this one, and I think the ones in the future of this book series are not bad. I don't think they're just there for, you know, cheap tricks or shock. I think they're there because they serve a point. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same boat. For people who are in the Discord or have listened to me in some of the movie episodes, y'all know I'm a big horror fan. And horror in itself is a genre that is often designed to try to discomfort you and make you a little upset to maybe examine some things about the world that you do not always want to look at. And I think there are a lot of cheap ways to do that visually, especially if you're looking at the horror medium for like slashers and things. I have a harder time seeing it as something, at least in the books I read, as a cheap trick. Because it often is presenting more context to the characters, all of the characters involved. And, you know, especially from the perspective of Alex in this book, this is a guy who has experienced a ton of trauma and is constantly living with that. And we haven't dug too deep into it in this book, but I think you can see that being part of his character at this moment. So it is kind of an introductory to the Dark Mages, but to me it's also, this is just getting at the surface of what his issues are.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything? Go for it.
Oh, there's lots more stuff here, Jingles. So we got to get predictions for you.
But
both.
Before we do that,
what do you think's going to happen in book two and the series? But Red, what do you need to do first?
I'm not going to say Portal Fantasy, so don't worry.
I'm ready to start shutting down.
When they are trying to escape the Mobius loop, and they're going out the back door at the direction of the wand, the way that Starbreeze and Luna stop him, because he has gone full on, I'm just going to take over the world now. And Starbreeze is like, it's not right, it's not right. And she's willing even to touch Luna, because Luna hurts her, just to stop Alex from leaving with the Fate Weaver. And then you see this part where Luna's gray mist turns into a gold light. And she basically, she doesn't punch, but the light hits, and she kisses Alex, and the light hits him, and is able to knock the Fate Weaver's mage out of his head, or get him to a place where he can control himself again. So I just thought that was a really cool scene, and I love it. And I love that Starbreeze and Luna care so much about Alex that they're not willing to let him lose himself. So,
yeah.
Okay. That's all I had to say.
Kind of on that. How early did y'all realize he was being taken over?
Pretty quickly.
You know, the first time I read it, I didn't realize it until she punched him. And then I was like, wait a minute. Yeah, why is he trying to take over the world? Hey, surely he's not fed up with it after just one book. But like,
yeah,
Yeah, I was painfully oblivious probably until it was like right in my face.
There was, I can't remember exactly where the moment was. It might have been right after he like realized that he could just choose which string of fate he wanted to go down. There was a point where there was a tonal shift in the way he was talking and narrating to us. And that's when I was like, oh, this isn't quite right. Something's up here. I think that was maybe the first time he mentioned like I could do whatever I want, or he treated Luna badly, or there was something at that moment.
I want to say it was when he was like, it's okay to leave Sanders behind, we'll come back for him later, and you're like,
yeah,
are you really? I don't think you will.
So I just one more thing I just thought of that I wanted to say is that Benedict Jacka, in just rereading this, he did a lot of good foreshadowing for the whole series in this book. There's hints to this in this book directly about what books 2, 3, and 4 are basically going to be about. And then there's even stuff that's far reaching all the way to the end of the series. So yeah, I mean, I don't want to say like try and limit it anyway, but I think he does really well with the foreshadowing and the hinting and dropping things into your view without being like, here's a clue, you know, like handing it to you. And then you being like, well, why didn't that drop in this book? You know, so I think he did well. But yeah, let's hear some prediction jingles. Predictions for book 2, which is named Cursed, and then predictions for the series.
Okay. So for book 2, the most I've got at the moment is that this is a Luna-focused book. And I think, you know, we've got some hints that Luna could die if they tried to unweave her curse from her life force. I think that's what Arachne said. But I think it still plays pretty prominently into, you know, her whole life. And I think Alex wants to try to help her where he can. So I don't see it being too early to have a Luna focused book, a Luna focused problem for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the whole series,
Don't you worry. We are taking great notes of this. We're going to talk about them with you.
We are going to laugh at you so hard. Serious. That's... Yeah.
I mean, you gave such a detailed description prediction there. Luna focused book. Great.
Yeah, great. Okay. Yeah. It's super focused. That's the best prediction you're going to get out of me. I'm going to cold read the crap out of this. Oh, wow. For the series as a whole, this is going to be another real deep one. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
I think Alex Virus is going to get angry at the world, and he's going to start dismantling councils.
Interesting.
That actually is interesting.
I think the neutrality thing is going to break at some point, and he's going to have to try doing other things. But I fully expect, you know, everyone that we've seen so far who just took the back seat in that last chapter, fully expect them all to come back. Morden's going to do some hunting. Levistus is going to do some hunting. We're going to have a guy on the run for a while. And ultimately, it's going to change the whole world dynamic.
All right, lots of predictions. Lots. I like that. So, I mean, this is a simple either or question. Do you see this series as being more episodic or more continuous storyline?
I see it more continuous storyline. I think this starting point was episodic, but I think the fallout of it could be far grander in the arc.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Good answer. I love it.
Okay. So before we close out here, why don't we get some plugs? Red, you want to go first?
I have a podcast with my co-host, Mark, and we do short stories in science fiction and fantasy, because sometimes you don't need to read a big old book.
Sounds good. I'm gonna tell Mark you said that though, and he's gonna laugh at you. And I host the Libromancy podcast, and I've covered the Alex Berry series. I love it. 15-minute episodes, because I don't have that much to say aside from they're great.
So 45 when I was on.
Go listen. That's true, but you're an exception.
So this has been the Green Team of the Legendarium's first dive into the Alex Vera series with Book 1, Fated. Please join us on the Legendarium Discord server, where we are always having a discussion about what makes a Portal fantasy, among many other topics.
Not much.
Thanks go to Craig and the Legendarium and Horizon Brave for starting the Green Team. Intro and outro music is Galactic Damages by Jingle Punks. For Chesky, Texas Blade, and Little Red Book, I'm Jingles. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye. Thanks. See you later.
Have a good one.